We started 2 Chronicles chapter 16 last week, and we want to again read the first six verses that we looked at then, just to refresh. And this is the same event that is described over in 1 Kings chapter 15 in verses 16 through 24 that we read some time ago as well. So this should be familiar to us, but just to refresh, we'll hear these verses again. It tells about when Baasha, the king of Israel, the northern kingdom, came to right on the border of Asa's kingdom and built up Ramah as a, which would be, number one, preventing Asa from being able to come up into the north into Israel, like his father had been able to do. It also would be serve as a point of threat, because then Baasha, the kings of the northern kingdom, would be in a position where they could threaten an invasion of Asa's kingdom. So this was a very difficult situation for Asa and for his people in the southern kingdom, Judah and Benjamin. And so there was a problem, and that problem needed a solution, and Asa came up with one, but it was not the best one. But we want to read those events here again in verses 1 through 6, and then we'll see what happens in response to that. So 2 Chronicles 16, 1 to 6. Brother Peter, you got that?
In the 16th 30th year of the reign of Asa, Baasha, king of Israel, came against Judah and built Ramah to the intent that he might let none go out or come in to Asa, king of Judah. Then Asa brought out silver and gold out of the treasures of the house of the Lord, out of the king's house, and sent Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, that dwelt at Damascus, saying, "There's a league between me and thee, as there was between my father and thy father. Behold, I have sent thee silver and gold. Go break thy league with Baasha, king of Israel, that he might depart, may depart from me." Ben-Hadad hearkened unto King Asa and sent the captains of his army against the cities of Israel. And they smote Ijon and Dan and Abelmaim and all the store cities of Naphtali. And it came to pass when Baasha heard it that he left off building a Ramah at his work cease. Then Asa, the king, took all Judah, and they carried away the stones of Ramah and the temple thereof, and what Baasha was building, and he built there with Eli and Mesmer.
Okay, so when we read that, on one level, we can read that and think, okay, well, this worked out great for Asa. When Baasha came and created this problem for Asa, then Asa solved it, and problem gone away now. But when we consider what we should consider about it, and what Asa should have considered about it, the way he went about solving this problem was not the right way. So get in mind again what was going on about this. So we have in Israel here the Sea of Galilee, the Jordan River, and the Dead Sea, or the Salt Sea, and then we have the So here we have Israel, the northern kingdom. We have Syria up here. We have Judah, of course, with Benjamin here. And so by building up Ramah, then that's going to block Judah from being able to pose a threat to Israel, and will in turn make a threat for Israel against Judah. Now, what you may recall with Abijam, what we had read about back in chapter 13, when he was king of Judah, this was Asa's father, and he was going up against Jeroboam, and there was conflict between, and we've talked about this, there had been conflict between the two kingdoms, north and south, since there was that split after Solomon died, and you have Jeroboam up here and Rehoboam down here. And there had been conflict ever since. I mean, it was natural that that would be the case as 10 tribes rebelled against the house of David, and you have the house of David still ruling here. So there's that rivalry and that conflict there, but it's not just political. I mean, the real essence of the division between the two at this point is spiritual. And that is something that we saw emphasized at the beginning of chapter 15 when the prophet came to Asa and mentioned how the kingdom, the northern kingdom, that of Israel, had been now for a long time since its beginning, since its inception, since Jeroboam the son of Nebat became king. And now here we are with Baasha as king, but through all this time, since the division of the kingdom, they had been without the true God, without a teaching priest, without law. They had removed themselves from the true God and removed themselves from his law. So they had become lawless and godless as far as how they were living in this world, as they had chosen that. Judah had, they still had the teaching priest, they still had the temple there. Those who were seeking God and desiring to obey him, they still had that opportunity right from the beginning, from Rehoboam after Solomon's death. I mean, that had not ended. The opportunity, the ability to be able to serve God was there and had been there throughout that time since the split. Now, that did not mean that their kings and their people were in large measure taking the proper use of that opportunity and blessing that God had given them where they could do that. We know that righteous ones in the northern kingdom came down and joined themselves to Judah right after the split because that was the only place where they could obey God because of Jeroboam and what he had done and made it impossible for people to be able to keep God's commandments as he had established a new religion for his kingdom. But under Rehoboam for his first 3 years, the king and the people were obeying the Lord. Well, then Rehoboam forsook the Lord. As he did, then the people did too, in large measure. But not entirely, because back in chapter 13 of 2 Chronicles, that chapter that gives us most of the information that we have in the scriptures about Abijah, Rehoboam's son and father of Asa, even though we do read in the book of 1 Kings how he was, he did not serve the Lord. He didn't walk in the ways of David. He did evil in the sight of the Lord. But what happened in 2 Chronicles 13, we see him as he was opposing in that battle with Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, and he had conflict with him during all throughout his brief reign. But one of those battles is, we're given those details about there in 2 Chronicles 13. And when he was opposing Jeroboam, what was he using as the strength of his argument that he was in the right in that conflict and Jeroboam was not? Well, there were some things that he said that were not accurate as he was speaking about really saying that the fact that there was a split in the kingdom, he was discounting that what God had said, and that was of him. So God was the one that chose that, and for the reasons that he gave at the time. But even though there were some definite inaccuracies in Abijam's version of the history, he did make a big point of the spiritual difference that was there between the two kingdoms, which was true. What he pointed out, well, we have God's priests, we have the altar and the sacrifices and all of those things. That was all true. Now, of course, the problem for Abijah himself was what? He wasn't obeying God. And many of the people were not either. And so there was a lot of wickedness there. But still, the ones who were righteous and seeking God, they could still do that. Well, then when Asa becomes king, he gets rid of the idols and the high places, many of them, gets rid of all the idols. Some of those high places of Solomon persisted all the way until Josiah's time. But Asa did much to clean up the kingdom that he now had reign over, and to remove, got the Sodomites out of the land and all those things, even removed his own mother from being queen because she had an idol. So he was very active in trying to remove the wickedness and have the people to serve God. And that has been the essence of his reign, as we've seen so much good in that. But we can remember back even with his father, there was that conflict there, but there was that spiritual division. But we also remember in 2 Chronicles 13, when Abijam was going against Jeroboam, where was that? It says it was up in Mount Ephraim. So that's where Judah's army was. The leader of the army under Jeroboam was Baasha. When he's now king, he doesn't want that back door open. He doesn't want that threat to be there to him, where in a conflict with Judah, that Judah can come up there and be up there. He wants it to, he wants to block that. And of course, he would obviously prefer any conflict that would be taking place there in Asa's backyard, not his own. So that's really what's behind Baasha's move to create this defense city there in Ramah, right there at the border of the rival kingdom. Well, that's a legitimate problem. There are a couple of ways that can be handled or solved. The fact that there's a spiritual division between the two kingdoms means, and the fact that Asa has been serving the Lord, means that God was there with him. Wasn't that the entire point of Azariah the prophet that came to him in 2 Chronicles 15? I mean, what were his words when he came to him? Remember 2 Chronicles 15 and verse 2. The Lord is with you while you be with him. And if you seek him, he will be found of you. But if you forsake him, he will forsake you. So there's that promise. And then he'd taken courage from that. And he and all the people had entered into a covenant that they would seek God. And it says they did. So there was that high point that we were reading about right there to the end of chapter 15. And then we get to this chapter, which is late in his reign, in the 36th year, which is out of 41. So this is year 36 out of 41 for his reign. So here we are at the end, and these events of this chapter are things that are happening here in the last 5 years of Asa's reign and his life. So up to now, everything we've read about has been positive. But now after all this time, here he is, his age is advancing, this situation arises. What has he always done up to now? Everything that we've read about up to now, and especially what we read in chapter 14, which is immediately on the heels of that, is when the prophet came to him to encourage him to continue to seek God. Well, he had had the Ethiopians come against him, 1,000,000+. And what had he done then?
Trusted
in God and asked God for deliverance, and told all the people to have their trust in God, and that the numbers didn't matter with God on their side. And then that same assurance came from that prophet right after that in chapter 15. Well, has that gone away? Is the truth of that, has that passed? Of course not. For some reason, right now, Asa doesn't go and ask the Lord to solve this problem. Would God have gotten Baasha out of his hair if he had asked him to solve that problem? Would God have taken care of that? Yeah. Now, how would he have done so? Well, we don't know exactly by what means he would have done so. I mean, what means are available to God? We read all kinds of ways in which he solved problems like that for Israel when they trusted in him. I mean, could he make the sun and moon stand still? Could he cast hailstones down? Could he send his angel into their camp and destroy? I mean, we could go through the history and look at the different ways and manners in which God gave deliverance to Israel through their history. I mean, how many ways could God choose? I mean, he has all power. He could have done anything. But what did Asa need to do in this situation? What would have been the right thing to do? The same thing he'd done before. Ask the Lord to deal with that problem. Now, we're going to read about, Lord willing, later, when Hezekiah becomes king and the Assyrians had already taken the northern kingdom and had taken Samaria and destroyed all of that northern kingdom and taken the remnant into captivity, and they were gone forever. And then that the Assyrians swept through Judah and took all their fenced cities, took everything, and then confined Hezekiah and his people. They were in that little island of just Jerusalem, surrounded by the Assyrians that had taken everything. And all these other nations. I mean, talk about bleak. Isaiah the prophet foretold that and described it as the waters overflowing its banks, like the Euphrates River, standing for the Assyrians in that metaphor, as waters rising up to the neck. But it didn't go over Hezekiah's head or the people of Judah. I mean, they were surrounded. I mean, they barely had their nostrils. They were about to drown. But what did Hezekiah do? The Assyrian king through Rabshakeh gave him that letter demanding that they give up. And so he spread it out before God and pled to the Lord for deliverance. And that's when God sent that angel into their camp and smote 185,000 of their troops. In the morning they were all dead corpses and they fled back to Assyria. So God gave them that deliverance in that manner at that time. They didn't have to fight. That's what happened. Hezekiah handled that situation in exactly the right way. In the same way that that Asa had handled the situation when the Ethiopians had threatened him back in chapter 14. For some reason, here in chapter 16, with all of that and knowing all of that and having that personal experience with that, with God's deliverance, with having the faith that he had, for whatever reason in this situation, he did not ask the Lord for the deliverance here. He came up with his own solution. What was his solution? To buy off the Assyrians, to break their alliance with Israel, to join him. And then in response, Syria took the offer, and so then they invaded Israel from up there, and so Baasha had to take all of his troops. He had to leave off building Ramah, go deal with the Syrians, and so then Asa could come in there and destroyed all that, and actually took all those materials and built his own strong place. So it completely went opposite for Baasha the way he intended. He ended up strengthening his enemy rather than himself. Well, that's what happens, isn't it, when someone is rebelling against God? Because we can ask the question, well, since he didn't ask the Lord in this case, why did he give success to Asa? Now, could God have defeated Asa's efforts there when he was trying to get help from the Syrians to solve his problem? Could God have thwarted those efforts and made that fail? Obviously he could. We have examples of God doing things like that. Why didn't he? Well, was he doing that to bless Asa in the situation, or would we view that action of God there as punishing and thwarting the rebellious people in the north? Well, that's very similar to what happened in chapter 13 when Abijam, who was a hypocrite, went up and was boasting of how they were righteous and following God. He wasn't. But if God was going to base the outcome of that battle between Abijam and Jeroboam in 2 Chronicles 13 based strictly on the two kings and their personal righteousness, then what would have been the outcome? Well, it would have been a tie, probably. I mean, oh, you could say, well, at least Abijam had better words than Jeroboam. So if you want to judge it on that, he had better words. But as far as the actions, they were both wicked. But God gave a victory to Judah then, but for whose sake? I mean, it wasn't for Abijam's sake. And in this case, this clearly would not have been God's endorsement of the way that Asa approached this. There were righteous people there in Judah, and the king and the people of the north were wicked. So there were reasons, there were good reasons why God gave a victory to the southern kingdom in both those instances. In chapter 13 under Abijam against Jeroboam, and here with Asa against Baasha, even though he wasn't seeking the Lord for to solve this particular problem. So in spite of the fact that God gave success to Asa and Judah here and defended them from Israel, it was in spite of the way that Asa had handled it. And now he's going to send a prophet to him to make that very clear. He's going to send a prophet to rebuke him for the way he had handled this problem. So if Asa was under any illusion thinking, well, I handled this well and I got success here, that illusion would be shattered by what the prophet's going to come and tell him, starting in verse 7. Well, let's go ahead and read 7 through 9 here in 2 Chronicles 16, 7 through 9. Brother Aaron.
And at that time, Hananiah, the seer, came to Asa, king of Judah, and said unto him, "Dost thou rely on the king of Syria and not rely on the Lord thy God? Therefore, his host of the king of Syria escaped out of thy hand. Will not the Ethiopians and the Rubens that you chose with very many chariots and horsemen? Yet because thou didst rely on the Lord, he delivered them into thy hand. The eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth, and he is strong in the behalf of those whose heart is perfect toward him, hearing that thou hast done foolishly. Therefore, from henceforth thou shalt have war."
Okay, so there's the rebuke. So here's Hanani. So how many prophets did God have? We read about Azariah in chapter 15. Now we're reading about one named Hanani. We don't have books of either of them. But we can read many, and we'll have other examples of this. But there were a lot of prophets that God used and spoke through. Well, we already saw that with Jeroboam. I mean, he sent that young prophet, we don't know his name, in chapter 13 of 1 Kings to rebuke Jeroboam and prophesy against the altar. He was the one that ended up getting killed by the lion because he disobeyed God and delayed and went to the house of that older prophet. So he paid with his life there. But anyway, that was a prophet that God had. And we also know about the prophet that Abijah that God had used to give the prophecy to Jeroboam that he was going to become king. And then after that, and that was the one who was old and blind in 1 Kings 14, that Jeroboam sent his wife in disguise to ask about their sick son and whether he would be healed or die. And so there are lots of prophets we've already seen during these years since the kingdom had split that God had speaking his word through. We don't have books from any of them, but there they are. In this case, there's this prophet Hanani. And Hanani the seer came to Asa. What did he say? Well, he said, "You relied on the king of Syria and not rely on the Lord your God. So on one level, we can say, well, this was a successful venture by Asa, relying on the king of Syria, because Israel, what Baasha was trying to do, failed. He lost this strong city that he was building up in Ramah, and actually the materials were taken over by Asa. But that's only part of the picture. Israel was a threat to Asa and to Judah, but who else was? Syria. Syria was itself a threat. And God is pointing out that had Asa sought the Lord, God not only would have defeated Baasha's efforts against him, the northern kingdom of Israel, but also what? He would have also subdued Syria under him. But since he relied on Syria, then Syria had escaped from Asa's hand. So this was a blessing that God would have given to Asa that he did not receive because he had not sought God like he should have and hadn't relied on God there. So when we look at it in from all the angles that the Lord is bringing up here, what Asa did was not how it turned out. It was only partially successful, only insofar as God was willing to give him success there for some reasons that are pretty easy to see based on the wickedness of Israel there. But it was not what God would have blessed, the full manner which he would have blessed them had Asa relied on the Lord. And so because of that, Syria escaped out of Asa's hand. And he also said because he had done that, he was going to have wars for the rest of the remainder of his reign. So he could have had. So now Syria, God was going to use Syria, these other neighbors, to cause problems for Judah as punishment for this. So he could have had Syria subdued, all these other. If he had continued to rely on the Lord that he had, as he had, then he could have had peace through the right to the end for those last years of his reign and his life. God would have blessed him with that, just like he had had peace at the beginning, because the end of his reign could have been like the beginning had been if he had done the same thing. But in this case, he chose not to rely on God, but he relied on the Syrians. Now, what big giant question does this beg? Why now? Why at this point did Asa not rely on the Lord? And he reminds him here in verse 8 of what happened with the Ethiopians. Were not the Ethiopians and the Labam a huge host with very many chariots and horsemen? Yet because thou did rely on the Lord, he delivered them into your hands. So he's reminding him of what he had done, himself had done before. He doesn't have to go back and look at other examples in Israel's history where God delivered them when his people had relied upon the Lord and trusted in him. He's bringing up an example from Asa's own past when he had relied upon the Lord and God delivered him. So why the change? Why the difference? What happened? Why didn't he rely on the Lord this time? Well, he doesn't go into all the reasons there. We can have, from other examples, we can consider some possibilities from other examples. I mean, does this mean Asa is now wicked, that Asa has no faith and doesn't believe in God anymore? No. In fact, we've already read right before this chapter started, because if we didn't have the statement that we do here that we have in 2 Chronicles chapter 15, verse 17, as we read chapter 16, we might think that Asa had completely turned against God, but he hadn't. His heart was perfect. That is, again, it's that form of shalom, at peace or safe with God. He has weakness, though, and he's displaying it now. What weakness is here? Well, we can look at we can consider some other righteous servants of God who in certain situations didn't rely upon the Lord like they should and suffered consequences from it. Going back into Israel's history, with Israel, since Israel has been a nation, we think of the most righteous people in the history of that nation, going back to its beginning. Well, let's think about it. Who comes to mind as the most righteous people that God tells us about of the nation of Israel from its beginning? Well, who was their leader at its beginning? What's that? I can't argue that. At its very beginning as a people, but as a nation, when was the birth of Israel as a nation? That was the prophet. So Abraham was one. I mean, he was certainly the father of it. But it goes back to when under Moses, when they started, when they were the Exodus at that time. That's why God had them to number their calendar. And I know that I'm asking you to read my mind a lot of times, which is you can't be punished for not being able to do that accurately. But at any rate. Of course, Jan's right. Abraham's the father of the nation through Isaac and Jacob. But as a nation, as a people, as a separate nation now that God had given birth to, that really begins at the Exodus from Egypt. That's when he got them to start their calendar. And then, of course, later they came into Canaan. So, certainly, the first leader of them, the one that led them out of Egypt and through the wilderness, right up to Canaan, and even through the first battles over there on the east of Jordan against Sihon and Og, those two Amorite kings over there, that would be Moses, the one through whom he gave them the law. So when we start thinking of Israel's history as a nation and their most righteous people, Moses, I mean, number one, we're going to think about him. But then right after that, I mean, during that same time, who comes to mind? What's that? Joshua. I mean, Joshua and Caleb, certainly. I mean, those two being the two spies that went in, that of the 12 total spies that went into Canaan, before they went there, and they were the two that came back with a good report with their faith in God. Of course, Joshua was the one that God then chose to be Moses' successor as leader, as judge of Israel, and was a prophet. And that's where we're going with this. Joshua is one of the most righteous men in Israel's history. He's one of the greatest examples we have in the Bible. Did Joshua trust in God? Yes. He did. His life is a life of trusting in the Lord. However, with that righteous man, Joshua, did he trust in the Lord in going against Jericho? He did. Because God told him exactly what to do if he didn't have his faith in God. Now, who would go against a city as mighty as Jericho with those walls like that? And who would go against it by marching around it in a circle once a day for 6 days and then seven times on the seventh day and have trumpets blown and carrying the Ark of the Covenant? Who would go through that kind of a ritual as a way of attacking a city like Joshua if that person did not fully trust in God? I mean, that from a military standpoint, would that make any sense whatsoever? Not at all. But that's what God told him to do, and because he did fully trust God, he followed that to the letter and made the people do so. And then when they did, what happened? God made the walls fall. But that showed his trust in the Lord. Well, right after that, I mean, how does the very next chapter begin, other than verse 1 of chapter 7 of the book of Joshua telling us about how Achan had taken of the accursed things from Israel? And that was something he told them in chapter 6. The fall of Jericho is in Joshua 6. And God had told them, had told them not to take to themselves of any of the spoil of Jericho. That was to go to the Lord's treasuries. Well, Achan took some items. The rest of Israel didn't know about it. And so then they went and fought against Ai in Joshua chapter 7. And when they went to fight against Ai, what happened? Well, let's read verses 2 through 5, Brother Trey, of Joshua chapter 7. So what happened? This is the first battle of Ai. What happened? Well, Israel fled. They were defeated. This was a small city. Was Joshua expecting that to happen? No. And then what does he do immediately after? Well, the next verse tells about how he went to the Lord. And so he was lamenting what had happened. Well, he went to God. Was Joshua surprised at this outcome? Yes. Why were they defeated? Well, God told him when he went to him afterwards and said it was because it was someone had taken of the accursed thing. Well, that rest of the chapter tells about how Achan was identified and he and his household were put to death to cleanse the camp of Israel. And so after that was done, because God was not with them while they had the accursed thing in their camp. Well, when that was taken care of, then in the chapter 8 is the second battle of Ai. What happened then? Well, Israel prevailed. But you can read the first two verses of chapter 8 of Samuel, and we'll see what happened there. Joshua receives instruction from the Lord exactly how to go about Ai with the ambush, and he follows that plan precisely, and they prevail. Well, just as God had given the precise plan for taking Jericho, and he followed it and prevailed. Well, did that happen at the beginning of chapter 7? Did Joshua go to God before the first battle of Ai and say, Lord, shall we go up against Ai? How shall we go up? Clearly not. I mean, he's talking to his people. This is a small city. And they didn't want to even waste the energy or the efforts of the entire army. So they even chose a smaller detachment of their army to go deal with this little insignificant Ai. Well, they lost. So they were shocked by the outcome. But what was the problem there?
Trusting in themselves.
They were. They were trusting in themselves there. I mean, they got caught up in the situation, well, we can handle this. When they just had big success at Jericho. And for this moment in time, they're not thinking about the fact, well, God's the one that gave us the victory over this giant Jericho. Even though Ai is small, we better not take a step without going to him first. Now, had they done so, had Joshua sought the Lord and said, God, shall we go up against Ai this time? And how shall we go up? Would God have just said, yeah, go up and then watched them get defeated? No. When he went to God after the defeat, God told him why. What if he'd gone to him before they went up the first time? Would God have said, don't go up, you've got, there's sin in the camp. I won't be with you. If you go up, you'll fall. It could have gone that way, but he obviously didn't go to the Lord. He and the people of Israel didn't go to God before that first battle. So there was a there was a lack of, they weren't thinking about it. They got into a situation there. Things had gone well, and so they were just going on and not thinking about, okay, what do we do here? We don't forget to ask God. The next chapter, people from, and after those two cities fall, the one that's next to Ai, and these were people from the city of Gibeon. Now that they know what's happened to both Jericho and Ai, and they can see themselves in the crosshairs, they're going to be next, or right close to next. And they actually had enough wisdom to recognize God was the one behind them, and that there was no way that they were going to be able to withstand Israel. They were going to end up being utterly destroyed. And so they were looking for a way here to save their lives. And so they disguised themselves, and they got moldy bread and old raggedy wineskins and shoes and all that. And then they deceived Joshua, told him they were from far away. The people even considered the fact that they could be attempting to deceive them. And because they said, Joshua said to them in verse 8, who are you and from whence come ye? And then they told him, verse 9, we are from a very far country. Thy servants are come because of the name of the Lord thy God. For we have heard of the fame of him and all that he did in Egypt. And what he did to the two kings, Og and Sihon. So they're telling the truth there. And then they were asking to make a league with them. So what did they end up doing there? They made a league with them. But let's look at why that happened. In Joshua chapter 9, let's go ahead and read verses 14 through, or 13 through 16. Let's see, Brother Michael.
These bottles of wine which we filled were due, and behold, they be rent. And these are garments, our shoes are become cold by reason of a very long journey. The men took of their victuals and asked not counsel at the mouth of the Lord. And Joshua made peace with them and made a league with them to let them live, and the princes of the congregation swear unto them. It came to pass at the end of 3 days after they had made a league with them that they heard that they were their neighbors and that they dwelt among them.
All right, now back in chapter verse 7, the men of Israel said to them, peradventure you dwell among us, and how shall we make a league with you? Did they consider the fact that they could be attempting a deception here? Yes. The deception was completed as they were convinced by the appearance that they gave. Look at our shoes, look at our bread and these bags. And then, of course, the words. Well, and they gave right and good words, and they fell for this. So even though it had crossed their minds, obviously, they might actually be people that dwell nearby that are trying to deceive us into making a league. They did anyway, and what was the problem in verse 13, or verse 14 that it points out? They found out after the fact that they actually were near neighbors, but what had they not done? They didn't ask counsel of the Lord. Now this is Joshua, so this is two times. Before the first battle of Ai, and now again here. So there are two times where a man as righteous as Joshua got burned because he didn't ask the Lord in those cases. So, Asa is a righteous man as well. But we're reading examples of some godly people who, in their lives, their habit is to seek the Lord, to trust in Him, and to ask of the Lord before they do something. But yet we read that there are times in the lives of ones like that where they erred because they didn't think to do it. Now, is there any lesson to be learned from that? Yes, Brother Allen?
What do you think, instead of they're not thinking good, that they thought it was something rather minor and they didn't want to bother the Lord with
it? Right. Either way, we want to put that. I mean, could that happen to us? Can there be situations in our lives, major or minor appearing, whatever they are? But no matter how, in throughout our lives, no matter how much we have made the habit of seeking God and relying upon Him, can a situation come up where, if we're not being very vigilant and thinking about it, that we're actually trusting in ourselves to handle the situation? We're going to do it our way, and maybe we're not thinking, okay, is this the way the Lord would have us to handle this? Is this what I should do? And then ask for that.
Well, that happens every day. You think, well, tomorrow I'll do this or whatever, but we can say that without thinking that we need to say by the Lord's will.
Yeah, and we need to ask the Lord for His will and guidance in everything. And so there's a great lesson to be learned from that. If it could happen to Joshua, if it could happen to Asa, are we thinking, well, not me? Well, if that's what we're thinking, we're already in trouble there, aren't we? But it's good to see these examples like this, to be reminded of that, because it is very easy to do. It's very easy for some little situation to come up and we just handle it ourselves, or just take some action without first stopping, considering, Lord, please bless me in this situation too, or provide, and looking at His Word, asking Him, really examining the situation, is this really the right thing to do? Is this the right way to do this? Because we can start that habit of just kind of going on and doing things and making decisions and handling situations, and we may be doing it all wrong. But the problem is, we may not be thinking about it like we should, or asking God to provide that direction for us. So it's really, this is an opportunity for us to think about that, because that can sure happen to us. And it did happen to Asa there, for whatever reason. But how did Asa respond to those words when the prophet came and let him know about this? Well, this shows another problem that is coming up in Asa, when we see his response in verse 10, when his prophet came to him and corrected him. Brother Jan, can you read verse 10 there of 2 Chronicles 16?
Then Asa was wroth with the seer and put him in a prison house, for he was in a rage with him because of this thing. And Asa oppressed some of the people at the same time.
That is not a good response. Now, at least he didn't kill the prophet, which is good. If he had murdered the prophet, he could have taken this in a direction or gone further with it where it would have been, he could have ended up being like one of the kings that's going to come up in a little while, Joash, who ends up killing God's prophet when he doesn't do right, and he full-blown turned away from the Lord. Well, Asa, as we've read, doesn't do that. But he doesn't do well in handling this, and it's with his immediate reaction, getting upset with the one that's telling you. He's not thought about the way to handle this problem that he had, solves it, does it his own way, and then when somebody comes with God's word to say, here's where you just messed up, then getting mad at the person who is telling them the truth. That is a very human thing to do. It's very typical for us to do things like that if we're not careful. So not only may we fall into the trap or fall to the temptation not to be trusting God like we should, to actually be considering every step we take to make sure it's right, but then to not have a good response when someone's trying to help us to see that, if we're not seeing it like we should. And that, unfortunately, is what Asa did. Now, we're out of time. We've got a bit more to go with looking at this. And then get to the last four verses of the chapter, where he's going to have another mess up. But we're really seeing three major ones here in this chapter. His not relying upon the Lord to solve that problem with Baasha, then getting angry when he was rebuked by God's prophet, and then he's going to trust in physicians and not the Lord to fix his feet. And that's what's coming up at the last. So we got some more things to look at with Asa. But with all three of those, if we're going to try to diagnose what the problem is that he has spiritually in this, is there one thing that's going to be common to all of those errors there? Trusting in himself and not the Lord, number one. Getting angry when rebuked. And then trusting in physicians and not the Lord for his healing. Is there a word to describe a problem that was in his heart that he was struggling with here? Pride. And late in his life. So does the devil give up? Does he give up trying to get us? He's not. And if he can find a weakness and get on that, he can cause us all kinds of problems even after we are well grown in the Lord, and after many years. So this is a very important chapter for us to look at and things to think about that can very well happen to us in our lives if we're not on guard and being very careful like we should. So we'll continue with that, try to finish up chapter 16 next time, Lord willing.